Baba, ya baba, what's more?
I'm Doug Storm. This is Interchange. Tonight's program is Confronting Black Jacobins, or the so-called Negro Problem. We opened our program with a song from the Haitian Folkloric Drum Ensemble. Historian and prolific author Gerald Horn returns to our program today to discuss his most recent book, Confronting Black Jacobins, The United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. That most recent label is about to expire, as he already has a biography of Paul Robeson coming out mid-February. The Haitian Revolution, the first successful slave revolt, had a profound impact on the United States, inspiring the enslaved and partisans of emancipation while striking terror through the southern slaveocracy. It propelled the fledgling nation one step closer to civil war. Gerald Horn's new book at once illuminates the tangled conflicts of the colonial powers, the commercial interests and imperial ambitions of the United States elites, and the brutality and tenacity of the American slaveholding class, while never losing sight of the freedom struggles of Africans both on the island and on the mainland. Gerald Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and he's the author of more than 30 books, including The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America, which he discussed with us last October, days before Confronting Black Jacobins was published. Professor Horn joins us by telephone. Welcome back to Interchange, Gerald Horn.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Gerald, it seems as if we could write the history of the, the whole almost of the Western world by detailing the history of the island that I believe Columbus dubbed Hispaniola, or perhaps it was Bartolome de las Casas, the 16th century Spanish historian. Maybe he deserves credit for that name as well. It seems like the naming of the island itself is a microcosm of conquest or imperialism. The Taino Amerindians, according to de las Casas, called the island Haiti, or mountainous land, and in 1804, revolutionary leader Jean-Jacques Dessalines recovered it as the official name of independent Saint-Domingue as a tribute to the Amerindian predecessors. Gerald Horn, with your Confronting Black Jacobins, you have given us the Western world placed under a microscope. Haiti is the smear mounted on your glass slide, it seems. What are you trying to show us by focusing tightly on Haiti and the Dominican Republic, but a tight focus yielding a broad vision?
Well, first of all, the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, as you noted, was a successful revolt of the enslaved, one of the few, if not the only, in global history. But I was trying to accomplish something else by chronicling this story. I was trying to present a new interpretation of why slavery decomposed when it did. That is to say that rather than looking in the parlors in London and Boston with regard to the certifiably heroic efforts of people like Wilberforce and Clarkson and William Lloyd Garrison, my thesis is that the enslaved themselves have to be given credit for abolishing slavery. That is to say that when the Haitian Revolution took place, 1791 to 1804, it ignited a general crisis of the slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse. And that decidedly includes its collapse in the United States of America. That is to say that with the Haitian Revolution, you began to see that the abolitionist movement and the world's then reigning superpower, speaking of Great Britain, began to accelerate, not least because the Haitian Revolution had significant impact on Britain's vast colonial holdings in the Caribbean, particularly Jamaica and, of course, Barbados. That is to say that if you look closely at the Haitian Revolution, if you look at the man who is oftentimes given credit for helping to light the fuse. And speaking of the man who has been bequeathed to us in history as Bookman, he was of Jamaican origin. And certainly there was this very close connection between events in what became Haiti and Jamaica. And with the Haitian Revolution and with the lurid headlines emerging from that revolutionary process, which suggested, as one contemporary historian has noted, although I don't necessarily agree, but it gives an idea of the gravity of this situation, this contemporary historian has said that the Haitian Revolution marked the genocide, a genocide against the slave owners, a genocide against Europeans. Now, I don't agree with that characterization, but it is fair to say that with the Haitian Revolution, slave owners and the slave-owning class began to confront a very stark reality. That is to say, move stolidly away from slavery or risk death itself. And they decided for the former rather than the latter. And so therefore, with the Haitian Revolution, you began to see movements in Britain to abolish, first of all, the slave trade, which takes place in 1807, a few scant years after the triumph of the Haitian Revolution. And then in the 1830s, you see Britain move to abolish slavery. But even before that, it had begun to place pressure on its former colonial holdings, speaking of the nation now known as the United States of America, because after the triumph of the United States revolt against British rule, that is to say the 1776 revolt, you begin to see how the United States slave owners began to move into the driver's seat in terms of the African slave trade, supplanting Britain. With Britain moving to abolish its own role in the slave trade, it was reluctant to see its previous role be taken by the United States slave traders. And so then Britain began to put pressure on the United States, first to abolish their role in the slave trade and then to abolish slavery as a whole. And that's one of the reasons why I argue that the Haitian Revolution and the Africans in Hispaniola in particular need to be given credit for helping to engineer a process that led to the abolition of slavery, particularly in the Caribbean and North America.
Well, if you don't mind, Gerald, it might be worth going back a little bit and trying to just understand Haiti generally as well, the importance of it as an island, how it's situated in the territory it's situated with, how it is sort of the port to the world in a sense for the slave trade and for coffee trade, for sugar, for indigo as well. Haiti itself was the most lucrative place in the New World, pretty much, wasn't it?
Haiti, or Hispaniola, is oftentimes given credit for being the most profitable colony that existed at that historical moment in time. That is to say that the enslaved Africans, as you correctly note, were producing massive super profits for the slave-owning class. This is also tied to the process of change in North America. What I mean is that if you look at what helps to ignite the revolt against British rule in North America, you fixate on the so-called Seven Years' War, 1757 to 1763, whereby London moved against France in Canada, particularly in Quebec, ousting it from Quebec, and then ousting the Spanish from Spanish Florida, at least for a few years, which then London calls upon its settlers in Carolina, in Georgia, in New York, to then pay for this favor that London had done by raising taxes, and you all know the story, rather than accede to this increase in taxes, taxation with our representation and all the rest, you see that the settlers in North America revolt against British rule. But you can't understand why their success took place against the world's reigning superpower without understanding the fact that they were assisted by France, which had settled score to settle with this internal eternal antagonist across the channel, speaking of London, and of course assisted by Spain as well. That assistance was bilateral. That is to say that the U.S. slave dealers, and of course the United States was a past master at smuggling, also these slave dealers were instrumental in smuggling Africans, or bringing Africans, I should say, into the island of Hispaniola to the point where on the verge of the Haitian Revolution, August 1791, in certain precincts on the island, you had the Africans outnumbering the Europeans, sometimes at a rate of 30 or 35 to 1, which presents a very difficult scenario for slave owners when the Africans decided that they no longer could tolerate the exploitation and oppression. Keep in mind that months before the igniting of the Haitian Revolutionary Process in August 1791, we had the French Revolutionary Process, July 1789. And in fact, the two processes, and indeed 1776, are all interrelated because in order to support the revolt against British rule by the North American settlers, the Parisian regime borrowed heavily and went into debt, and then that led to a fall in living standards in France, which then helps to create kindling for a revolutionary process. And as already noted, the North Americans were bringing Africans onto the island at the same time, and all of this presents a very exquisite recipe for a revolutionary slave revolt, which then unfolds between 1791 and 1804. Now, in the early stages of this revolutionary process, London, like most of the European colonial powers, intervened to squash it. That is to say that London recognized that if this revolutionary process on Hispaniola was successful, that like revolutionaries elsewhere and everywhere, that the Haitian revolutionaries would seek to spread their gospel to Jamaica, to Barbados, to St. Kitts, etc. But London suffered one of the most ignominious and severe setbacks in British imperial history at the hands of these revolutionaries. And London, to its credit, was able to recognize that that meant the jig was up for slavery, which leads to London moving step by step towards abolishing the slave trade in 1807 and abolishing slavery itself in the 1830s. Now, in the United States itself, there was a split with regard to the early stages of the revolution. That is to say, certainly in Dixie, in the South, there was regnant fear about what this revolutionary process meant for slavery in North America. At the same time, north of the so-called Mason-Dixon line, you had shipping interests who thought that they could make a pretty penny by dealing and trading with these revolutionaries. Likewise, you had those on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line who thought that the better part of wisdom would be to see France ousted from the hemisphere. That is to say that the so-called Louisiana Territory, which actually stretches not only with regard to the present state of Louisiana, but northwards to what is now the Canadian border, after France is ousted from Haiti, the most lucrative colony in its portfolio, France then moves to liquidate its holdings in North America, which leads to the so-called Louisiana Purchase, which increases the territorial expanse of the United States of America. So you could see the United States, to a certain extent, being a beneficiary of the Haitian Revolution. But at the same time, as noted, there was a fear, an understandable and justifiable fear in Dixie, that the flame of slave revolt would spread from the Caribbean into North America. And of course, if you look at Gabriel's revolt circa 1800 in Virginia, that revolt has Haitian fingerprints all over it. Indeed, if you look at a number of key slave revolts that take place in the Americas in the first few decades of the 19th century, not only Gabriel's revolt, but the revolt in Louisiana circa 1811, which bears the brand of being the most significant and largest revolt of the enslaved in U.S. history, the leaders of that particular revolt, many of them had been enslaved on the island, and the slave owners, as you know, began to flee the Caribbean, and many of them went to Cuba, but of course many of them came to New Orleans. And those Africans who came to Louisiana then helped to lead a revolt there that was squashed in 1811. Then at Barbados in 1816, if you look at the testimony of the enslaved with regard to that fearsome revolt, number one, there was this assertion that the Haitian Navy was steaming towards Barbados at the time that the revolt was unfolding, number one. And number two, the Africans who were interrogated, of course, after a bit of persuasive torture, oftentimes said that they intended to walk in the footsteps of Haiti, that the only way they could gain their freedom was to fight like the Africans had done in the colony that was once known as Santo Domingo, but of course we know as Haiti. Denmark Vesey's revolt in the early 1820s in South Carolina. You know, you may recall that Denmark Vesey's revolt, first of all, Denmark Vesey apparently as a sailor had spent time on the island of Hispaniola. But secondly, the idea, according to testimony that has come down to us, was that the Africans would not only revolt, but then try to get a ship and sail southwards to Haiti itself. And then, of course, Nat Turner revolt circa 1831 in Virginia, one of the bloodiest revolts in the bloody history of slavery in the United States, that revolt unfolded virtually to the day in August 1831 on the 40th anniversary of the August 1791 revolt that ignited the Haitian Revolution. And there was a real fear in Virginia that some of the Africans who revolted in Virginia were too inspired by the Haitian Revolution. So I could go on in this vein, but I think you get the picture.
Gerald, thank you. This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest tonight is Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History at African American Studies at the University of Houston and author of Confronting Black Jackamans, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. It's time for a break. We'll have more on the Haitian Revolution when we return. This is Doug Storm on Interchange on WFHB.
We be Napoleon, yep, we be Napoleon. 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 Nowadays, you could die from too much sodium. We hearing lies from the guys behind the podiums. But while the whole world is warm for petroleum, we can't forget that the Haitians beat Napoleon. Yep, it started 1791, the whip crack. The cracker said, this is what I need done. A voodoo priest gazed high into the shiny sun and thought I'd probably get caught if I try to run. I cannot make it so they'll never be pursuing me. He held a ceremony, started preaching unity. Within 10 days of taking out Revenge Day, took over the North Province, bondage abolished. By the next year, 1792, they gained a third of the island since the fight ensued. Niggas was wildin', French bodies was piling. They tried to give rights to the free, the end of violence, but it was too late. The Haitians wasn't giving in to leave their kin in the condition they was living in. By 7 trade, the French was warring with the Brits. The Spanish took the British side and got up in the mix. The blacks fought along with Spain. The French caved and emancipated all these slaves. It wasn't over though, cause Britain and Spain figured they was royalty was set in the rain. So a black commander who was fighting for the Spanish crown fought for the French, former slaves held them down. This was in 74, they fought for 4 years, sent the British home running, they was all tears. In 1800 went to Santo Domingo, and by 01 they freed the slaves from the gringos. But Napoleon needed slaves, he tricked the commander and then he had them locked away. For a few months Napoleon was back in power, but then the general took wind with smelling something sour. His name was Dessalines. He led an next rebellion and chased him out the scene. His body sunk in the ravine. Established a republic, policy was closed door since the first of the year in 1804. Big up to Dessalines, big up to Toussaint, big up to Bookman, big up to Petion. January the 1st, don't watch the ball drop. We celebrate independence, bring out all stops. My soup Jumouet.
Welcome back to Interchange. This is Doug Storm. Tonight, my guest is Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston and author of Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. We just heard We Beat Napoleon by Stray Poem. We went to the break, Gerald. There was a lot there to deal with, to talk about, to think about. Lots of revolutions, lots of revolts, lots of I guess, details. Part of the problem with this particular situation for me is that there's just so much going on. Trying to understand how the world is roiling and at this time, and how this island is kind of at the center of everything, how the international trade game or politics of France as it is working out on working through on the island itself, the French colonists and slave owners, masters, etc., plantation owners, which I guess included free men of color as well, gens de couleur, I think that's what they're called. And all this is happening in sort of internal strife as well. So France is having trouble with its colonists the way London had trouble with its colonists as well. And there's obviously Spanish difficulties and trouble with the mainland, the slave-holding republic, as you call the United States. So there's just kind of so much to keep track of in this. There's a thing I came across in your book, Thomas Jefferson, A Letter to Aaron Burr, the February 11, 1799. He says, it's impossible the French should invade us since the annihilation of their power on the sea. Our constituents will see in these preparations the utmost anxiety to guard them against even impossibilities. The southern states do not discover the same care, however, in the bill authorizing the president to admit Toussaint's subjects to a free commerce with them and free ingress and intercourse with their black brethren in these states. However, if they are guarded against the cannibals of the terrible republic, they ought not to object to being eaten by a more civilized enemy. Can you unpack that for us?
Well, that's a very controversial phrase, and it's been interpreted many different ways. The obvious way to interpret it is to say that Jefferson meant what he said. That is to say that, like many before and since, he was associating Africans with cannibalism. And, I mean, there was a real fear that the Africans were on the march. And people need to realize that there was not only a demographic imbalance favoring the Africans on the island of Hispaniola. As noted, sometimes the ratio was 30-1, Africans to Europeans. But for a good deal of its history, you had a state like South Carolina, which in many ways was an epicenter of slavery, that had a black majority. And this led to quite a bit of fear, perhaps guilty fear, on the part of the slave owners as to what the Africans might have in store. In fact, I was listening to your previous program on blacks and policing and the current state of police shootings, be it in Chicago or New York or South Carolina, et cetera. And I think that part of what's missing with regard to that very worthy debate and discussion generally is connecting that to the historical process of slavery and the fear that the blacks would rise up and therefore you need to lay heavy manners on them, as they say in the Caribbean, that they needed to be repressed and suppressed, and therefore you get this police killings. I should also say that the Haitian Revolution needs to be seen not only as a race question, but also as a class question. That is to say that when the revolutionaries triumphed on the island, this was a blow against slave labor, which seemed to be spreading like an amoeba throughout this hemisphere. But with the triumph of the Haitian Revolution, you saw attempts to curtail slave labor, which of course eventuates in the U.S. Civil War, culminating in 1865. And that is a boon for all working people, not only because of this rather peculiar phenomenon you have in the United States, the so-called light-skinned Negro, you know, in South Africa, there's the colored population where the lighter-skinned with African ancestry have their own kind of racial category, whereas in the United States, everybody with African ancestry has been collapsed into one category called black, irrespective of their melanin content. But that also opened the possibility that Europeans, fresh off the boat from Ireland or Italy, for example, into New Orleans, could be traduced and somehow they could be presented as being black when they actually were, but they're light-skinned Negroes who look white, unquote. So in other words, when slavery suffered a blow in Haiti, it not only was a boon for people of African descent, it was a boon for people of European descent, not only because of what I've just sketched for you, but also because slave labor brought down the wage level generally. That is to say, if a radio engineer has to compete with slave labor, a slave labor radio engineer, well, then that's going to drive down the wages and compensation of the radio engineer. So therefore, when slavery suffered a grievous blow, the working class simultaneously was uplifted. It's no accident, as the historians like to say, that after the U.S. Civil War, you began to see gigantic steps towards an eight-hour day, towards trade union organization, et cetera, because the abolition of slavery was a boon for the working class in general.
The thing that was as interesting in this particular period as well is trying to understand the, as you speak of class in particular, the divisions on the island between, again, those that understanding of the gens de couleur, the free men of color, free people of color, to try to understand those class relationships as well. The free men of color, free people of color also owning slaves, enslaving an enslaved population, also being party to raids and piracy as well, and trading in the same manner as the white plantation owners also.
Well, it's very striking if you look at the history of the United States, as we all know, and I've just articulated, you have this phenomenon of lighter-skinned Negroes. I mean, you can look like you're the first cousin of Madonna, but if you have the faintest hint of African ancestry, you're designated as black. Well, there's been a particular kind of historical evolution for us to get to that point. As your comment tended to suggest, in the 19th century, you had a small class of slave owners who today would be called light-skinned Negroes, not only in New Orleans, but to a degree in Charleston as well. And what's striking is that many in this category had fled from the island of Hispaniola. They had fled like their so-called 100% pure European counterparts because of the fear of slave revolts and the fear of enraged Africans. But what's striking is that when they get to the North American mainland, they're not necessarily embraced wholeheartedly as class brethren. Many in the so-called white population see them as not necessarily being trustworthy, because there was this narrative about the Haitian Revolution that it was ignited in August 1791, not least because the gens de couleur and those of so-called mixed racial ancestry were demanding equal rights like their lighter or whiter counterparts, and that this creates discord that then the Africans take advantage of. And so there was a fear that that same kind of tension and contradiction would be brought to the North American mainland, which leads to a certain kind of skepticism towards this group. Despite the fact that during the War of 1812, when the United States barely retains its sovereignty after the Redcoats invade, after the British invade, one of the major reasons why the United States was able to turn back the Redcoats in the pivotal Battle of New Orleans, December 1814, January 1815, was precisely because of the staunch support that the Stars and Stripes received from the gens de couleur, from the so-called lighter-skinned Negroes. And it's very striking to note as well that Louisiana, for a good deal of its history during the 19th century, had embraced this population much more so than other parts of the United States. But what's also striking is that if you go back to your high school or college history lessons, you may recall the case of Plessy versus Ferguson in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. This is the case where the U.S. Supreme Court basically lays down the law with regard to separate but equal. Mm-hmm. But what's striking is that the plaintiff in this case, Plessy, Homer Plessy, was a lighter-skinned Negro, and he wanted to not be forced to sit in the same train car as the darker skinned, he either wanted to sit with those defined as white, or perhaps a la South Africa, to have a separate car for the lighter skin. But the Supreme Court said no. They frog marched the lighter skinned Negroes into the overarching category of blackness, which is where we are today. What this also tends to suggest is that since we know that there has been a certain kind of historical evolution with regard to race and color in the United States, as the case of Homer Plessy suggests, we may, in the 21st century, see a further evolution, although in which direction, it's unclear.
This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest is Gerald Horn. He is the author of Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. I think trying to understand the origins of those particular issues at this time and of the Haitian Revolution is still, I think, fruitful to go back and try to understand the creation of those codes or gradations of blackness that I think begin in that period. Maybe this is earlier than 1791, but like 1763 or something like that, where there's a clear, I think, an idea that's economic on its face, perhaps, to create more of a category of blackness and equate that with the enslaved.
Well, certainly, if you look at my 1776 book, there is a thesis in that book about the evolution of whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that, as I trace it, you begin to see the evolution of this overarching category whereby those who were oftentimes warring on the shores of Europe, English versus French, English versus Irish, Poles versus Russians, Serb versus Croat, etc., when they crossed the Atlantic, they're merged into this overarching category of white American. It's sort of a new category. And as I trace it, that comes in more or less, or at least it accelerates in the 1660s, when you begin to see the acceleration of the African slave trade. Now, likewise, if you look at this category of blackness and the collapsing of those we would now characterize as Angolan and Congolese and Nigerian, et cetera, well, obviously, that if you can designate this group that you also designate as being, quote, racially inferior, unquote, to be the slave, to be the slave category, well, then this can be very profitable, this new category of blackness. And therefore, you begin to see how then other groups then sort of fit into the spectrum between whiteness and blackness. Now, what happened is, of course, the Haitian revolutionaries tend to upset the apple cart because it shows that the Africans, that they have a vote in this process. And their vote can oftentimes be executed with a maximum amount of bloodiness. But sadly and unfortunately for the Haitian revolutionaries, there is a counter-reaction to their revolutionary process, particularly spearheaded by the United States and France. You may recall that in the 1820s, the Haitians were forced to pay reparations and indemnity to the former slave owners of the island. And what's striking is that many of these former slave owners, as noted, have already decamped to New Orleans, which helps to explain why before 1861, before the U.S. Civil War, New Orleans probably had more millionaires per capita than any other city in the United States of America, not least because of the sweat and toil and labor and the compensation and the reparations paid by the Haitian government to the former slave owners. And then there's the United States of America. After the triumph of the Haitian Revolution in 1804, the eastern side of the island was still controlled by Spanish colonialists. But Spain, as you know, was wobbling at that point. Throughout the hemisphere, you begin to see revolts against Spanish colonial rule, be it in Mexico, all the way south to Argentina. And so what happened is that in 1822, the Haitian revolutionaries from the western side of the island march eastward, take over the eastern side of the island, unite the entire island of Hispaniola under Haitian rule, and many of those Spanish slave owners, because the Haitians also abolished slavery, then move on to Cuba, where slavery is not abolished to the 1880s, or to Puerto Rico or other Spanish colonial possessions. Then, in order to fortify their rule on the United Islands, the Haitian revolutionaries begin to invite U.S. Negroes, the free U.S. Negro population. And free U.S. Negroes migrate to the eastern side of the island in the five figures. That is to say, maybe 13 to 24,000 estimated. But what happens is that the empire strikes back, because in 1844, in one of the most important and successful covert actions of Washington, helping to ignite a long and disdainful trail of covert actions, the United States supports a revolt against Haitian rule on the eastern side of the island, which leads to the Dominican Republic, and which also leads to a long chapter of bloodshed between Haitians and Dominicans, which arguably continues to this very day, because you, if you consult your headlines, you'll see that there is continuing simmering unrest between Haitians and Dominicans. The Dominican government has expelled many of its nationals that it considers to be Haitian, mostly because they're darker skinned. There's a certain amount of color phobia on the island, particularly in the higher reaches of the Dominican government. And this is creating a human rights catastrophe right now as we speak. You may recall that even before that, in the late 1930s, that the Dominican dictator, Rafael Trujillo, executed en masse thousands upon thousands of nationals of the DR, who he said were Haitians. And so this origin that I'm talking about of the Dominican Republic, number one, it can be laid at the doorstep of Washington as a way to strike back against the abolitionist isle, that is to say Haiti. But number two, it is continuing to reverberate to this very day.
Yeah, let's unpack that a little bit more in when we come back from the break. This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest tonight is Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Chair of History at African American Studies at the University of Houston, author of Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and Origins of the Dominican Republic. We'll have more with Gerald Horn on Interchange. Stay with us.
Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and Lenny's Brew Pub, the original location of the Bloomington Brewing Company. Menu includes pizzas, sandwiches, salads, and more. Located at 1795 East 10th Street, 812-323-2112. More information, including full menu, at lennysgourmetpizza.com.
This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest tonight is Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. Before we went to the break, Professor Horn was talking about the creation of the Dominican Republic in 1844, I think, or I think that was perhaps when it was declared its independence. I'm not sure, Gerald, you can correct me I want to get back to that in particular. But first, as to reverberations of the Haitian Revolution and these kinds of continuing conflicts, let me read something from the noted anthropologist Sidney Mintz, who just died at age 93. This was in 2010, and in response to the image cast up by Western media of Haiti after the devastation of the January 12 earthquake. This was titled Whitewashing Haiti's History: The World Never Forgave the Slaves Who Freed Themselves. Quote, nations have beginnings and then national histories, and the history of each is unique. I know how obvious that is, but the penchant among journalists and political scientists for creating phony categories, such as kleptocracies, developing nations, and failed states, and then using these categories to obstruct serious talk, in this case about Haiti, immobilizes us and conceals the need to uncover the weight of local and particular history. The New World's Second Republic has indeed known political strife, bad leadership, and poverty, but to judge Haiti fairly, it is essential to remember that the country won its independence under the worst imaginable circumstances. The Haitians declared their freedom in 1804, when the New World was mostly made up of European colonies and the United States, all busily extracting wealth from the labor of millions of slaves. This included Haiti's neighbors, the island colonies of France, Great Britain, Denmark, and the Netherlands, among others. From the United States to Brazil, the reality of Haitian liberation shook the empire of the whip to the core. Needless to say, no liberal-minded aristocrats or other Europeans joined the rebel side in the Haitian Revolution, as some had in the American Revolution. The inescapable truth is that the world never forgave Haiti for its revolution because the slaves freed themselves. Unquote. Again, Sidney Mintz, who just died at age 93. Gerald, that's I think that's unfortunately how Haiti had sort of been in my head for a long time as a person in the United States, not having much education beyond the boundaries of Western civilization, I suppose. Haiti was a place that, if it popped into my mind at all, it was one in which there was just bad stuff going on down there.
Well, first of all praises due to the late Sidney Mintz. That was a very well-written statement that you just read. And I would like to second it and echo it. That is to say that Haiti had a very difficult diplomatic dance to perform. That is to say, as Professor Mintz's comment suggests, it was surrounded by antagonists. I mean, to show you how difficult Haiti's journey was, that because Britain was the reigning superpower, and because Britain was terrified by the prospect that the Haitians would intervene in neighboring Jamaica, leading to significant losses for London, then Britain moved towards abolition, and therefore Britain became a kind of ally of Haiti against slavery. But when your primary ally is a nation whose nickname is Perfidious Albion, which is how London is referred to in Washington in particular, it gives you an idea of the difficult road to hoe that Haiti had. That is to say, unlike the Cuban Revolution, and you know I published this book, I guess it was 2014, Race to Revolution in the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, which looks at Cuban history up to the triumph of the revolution. But of course, we know that after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, January 1st, 1959, approximately 155 years after the triumph of the Haitian Revolution, January 1st, 1804, we know that Cuba, revolutionary Cuba, entered onto the world stage under much more propitious circumstances than Haiti. I mean, for example, it had a world socialist movement and national liberation movements to ally with, not to mention a conscious working class movement in the North Atlantic countries, which helped Cuba to survive. Haiti had no such benefit. And it's striking to note that the United States only recognized Haiti during the midst of the U.S. Civil War, that is to say about 1862, after seeking to isolate, if not overthrow, the revolutionary process. And so if you compare the two islands, the United States did not recognize Cuba to a degree until 1914. That's, 41, 55 years after the triumph of the revolution, and it took 58 years for the United States to recognize Haiti. So I guess you could say there's progress. But at the same time, it's important to note that when the United States did recognize Haiti in 1862, the United States was on the ropes because of the Traitors' Rebellion of the so-called Confederate States of America, which sought to overthrow the U.S. government and split the nation in half, if not liquidate the United States of America altogether. And what's striking is that there were many in the so-called Confederate States of America who saw Haitian citizens as potential slaves. I go to some length in the book to detail a case of a Confederate sympathizer and supporter who was arrested in Haiti for seeking to kidnap Haitians and drag them into slavery either in Dixie or on the island of Cuba. And in fact, there were repeated efforts from the triumph of the Revolution in 1804 up until the abolition of U.S. slavery circa 1865, whereby U.S. and or CSA, Confederate States of America nationals, were seeking, oftentimes successfully, to kidnap Haitian citizens and drag them into slavery. So the Cuban Revolution obviously has had a steep uphill climb, but when you compare it to the uphill climb of the Haitian Revolution, which not only had to worry about its sovereignty being liquidated, but also of its entire citizenry sold into slavery, it gives you an idea of the difficulties of that regime and government, a government that was not allowed to devote a good deal of its treasury to education and health care, but had to spend a disproportionate amount of its budget on the military in order to defend its sovereignty and to defend against being enslaved, which obviously deforms the budgetary process, it deforms the educational process, it deforms the healthcare choices of Haitians, and goes a long way to explaining why in 2016, whenever Haiti is mentioned, it oftentimes carries the descriptor of the poorest nation in the hemisphere. Well, there are historical reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest is Gerald Horn. He is the author of Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. Gerald, you talked earlier about the idea of the aid to the laboring classes, the abolition of slavery, and how this begins to change even the working class idea, or you know, who's in charge of whose work and how we get paid for that, and the 8-hour workday and such. It was interesting to me that I think it was the Code Noir that had given unparalleled rights to slaves, even days off as well at the time. And this is, I guess, prior to 1763, 1685 or something like that. And the idea of the laboring class kind of rests inside that space as well, doesn't it?
Well, it's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking about a book by the late Yale professor Edmund Morgan, American Slavery, American Freedom, mm-hmm. Which tends to connect those two phenomena. Hmm. It came out over 40 years ago. And that book is still worth reading and still worth studying, because if you contrast the experience of slavery in North America with the experience of slavery in the Caribbean, you mentioned Code Noir, mm-hmm. and the fact that slave owners in the Caribbean, oftentimes because they were outnumbered, sometimes, as noted, up to 30-1, they were not necessarily in an advantageous bargaining position, even though they were slave owners, which leads to the so-called reforms, or what the British called amelioration of slavery, when they were trying to preserve this peculiar institution in the first two decades of the 19th century. Whereas the United States, because of this phenomenon of whiteness, that is to say, Britain and most of the other European powers were ethnic equation, that is to say, English versus Irish. Whereas,
Gerald, can you hear me?
Yes.
You're cutting out a little bit there. Maybe back up and try again.
Oh, okay. I was talking about Edmund Morgan's book.
We got to the point where after amelioration of slavery with Britain, and then you started to cut out.
Oh, I see. So what I was trying to point out is that with the phenomenon of whiteness, which is taken to the nth degree in the United States of America, this also means that in order to attract European migrants to what was in effect a war zone, speaking of North America, mm-hmm. with rambunctious Native Americans and very militant enslaved Africans, the United States had to make a better bargain, a better deal to attract these migrants. And so they began to offer them not only land, oftentimes was stocked with slaves, but they also offered them a certain kind of package of democratic rights. And that's where many of our friends on the left have made a mistake when they talk about what they call bourgeois democratic rights. Well, they are bourgeois democratic rights, that is to say, right to freedom of the press and right to vote and all that. But they're also racial rights, because one of the reasons why these so-called bourgeois democratic rights have been so difficult to extend to the rest of us who have not been allowed to enter the hallowed halls of whiteness is because they were not only bourgeois rights, they were racial rights. And until that nettle is grasped, it seems to me we're going to have difficulty in plotting a way out of the crisis in which this country now finds itself.
Well, you know, another thing that struck me during this, and why I found such a fascinating period and really kicked myself for not having thought about it before or even done any reading whatsoever on this revolution, is that in this period, you talked about sovereignty, and I don't think we talked about the rights of man. We talk about, at this very period, there's you know, discussion and argument and philosophizing and enlightenment values about, you know, being a freed individual, being at liberty, and the rights of individuals and men, and then having to decide who in, who isn't a man or not. And sovereignty strikes me in that same way, the fact that the island was populated, heavily populated by indigenous peoples before it was taken over by, after being settled by Columbus, I guess, after it was taken over and quickly most of those indigenous peoples were killed. And then the idea of sort of a created land of a particular kind of new people, right? It's an island that is basically repopulated and then seeks sovereignty.
Well, that is correct. And in terms of further research, since I know I'm speaking to some of your audience who may be academics, mm-hmm. that part of the further research that needs to be done with regard to slavery, not only in Hispaniola, not only in Haiti, but I would say it also in North America, is trying to trace the African roots, the African ethnicity of those who are now called Haitian or African American, etc., because I think that would tell us a lot about the contemporary United States or contemporary Haiti. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think we need to know more about the cultures of the indigenous population. The people who were in the Americas well before the advent of European colonialism and slavery, because I dare say that there is a good part of this culture that we now find ourselves in that was shaped indelibly by the fact that this land was walked by indigenous people for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and therefore that is a very fruitful path of research, and I think the research can be done. Certainly the archaeologists have been very good in helping to explain what can be understood in the absence of written records. Mm.
Gerald, we don't have a lot of time. Could you quickly outline the idea of annexation and deportation? Again, maybe 2 minutes?
Oh, sure. Well, it's interesting that, as noted, the United States helped to give birth to the Dominican Republic circa 1804. Bloodshed ensues between Haiti and the Dominican Republic for years thereafter. Then the United States gets enmeshed in the Civil War, 1861. It triumphs, let us say the United States triumphs over the Confederate States of America in 1865. But the question still was hanging as to what to do with the newly freed enslaved population of the United States. Part of the idea was to get rid of this population. That is to say, if the idea was that slavery was the cause of the bloody Civil War, then if you get rid of the slaves, you get rid of a potential bloody problem. But the question is where to send them. So part of the idea was to annex the island of Hispaniola and sending newly freed Africans from North America there, that episode, that attempt, barely fails in the U.S. Congress by a vote or two. Otherwise, a person like myself, instead of sitting here in North America speaking to you on the telephone in the English language, might be on the island of Hispaniola speaking French or Creole or Spanish.
Well, thanks very much, Gerald. We're going to have to call it a night at that. That's our show. Gerald Horn is the Rebecca. I'm going to remember that one, Gerald. I've written it many times now. The John J. and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston and the author of Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. Thank you, Gerald. Always an education.
Thank you for inviting me.
Remember, Gerald Horn has a biography of Paul Robeson coming out in mid-February. Robeson was a world-famous singer and actor, a trained lawyer, an early star of American professional football, and a polyglot who spoke over a dozen languages. These could be the crowning achievements of a life well-lived. Yet for Paul Robeson, the higher calling of social justice led him to abandon both the NFL and Hollywood and become one of the most important political activists of his generation. Again, Gerald Horn has a new book about Paul Robeson coming out mid-February. Next week, I'll speak with Freddie DeBoer about his article in Harper's on Louis Farrakhan, Black Lives Matter, and the Future of Black Political Leadership in the United States. If you enjoyed this program, you can find more like it online at wfhb.org/news/interchange. And if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please send me an email, interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks for listening. We'll close with Charles Mingus's Haitian Fight Song off of The Clown from 1957. I didn't give this a chance last week due to running out of time, so I thought we'd try again. Mingus said this of his song, that it could just as well be called an Afro-American fight song. It has folk spirit, the kind of folk music I've always heard anyway. It has some of the old church feeling, too. I was raised a Methodist, but there was a Holiness church around the corner, and some of the feeling of their music, which was wilder, got into our music. My solo in it is a deeply concentrated one. I can't play it right unless I'm thinking about prejudice and hate and persecution and how unfair that is. There's sadness and cries in it, but also determination. This is Doug Storm. I produce Interchange. Jonathan Richardson is our board engineer. Joe Crawford is our executive producer. Haitian Fight Song by Charles Mingus takes us into the jazz menagerie.